Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. Tell us what you think of it by leaving us a review on iTunes or by letting us know on Twitter or Facebook.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry on a Monday. Thanks for listening and joining us this hour. And we're really grateful for all of your engagement at thetakeaway.org, tearing up our TV brackets, just like the basketball results over the weekend undoubtedly dashed the fortunes of nearly anyone following the NCAA tournament. Later this hour, the first results of our TV Greats head-to-head tournament. Hint, data is alive.
Yes, very humorous indeed. Hysterical, in fact.
Such a chucklehead, that data. We'll have some real data to share with you this hour that's not funny about the environment in peril. We will look at an unforgiving environment, from mudslides in Washington State to contaminated water in North Carolina and an oil spill in East Texas. We are going to recall how back in the 1980s, revolutionary reproductive technology brought babies into this world that might never have been born, but how that same technology also gave unexpected jobs to lawyers. Actually, we should probably always expect that technology will make more jobs for lawyers. Later this hour, we look back at the Baby M case and how it started a legal argument that is still going on today. But we begin this hour with the Crimea crisis, which will dominate a G7 meeting at The Hague. The Crimea crisis has, like the territory of Crimea itself, been folded into a larger sense that this is a Russia crisis now. Here is former Bush administration official Paul Wolfowitz speaking to the BBC.
What's happening in Ukraine is not just about Ukraine, it's about Russia. When he goes and brutalizes Chechnya, when he goes and invades Crimea, suddenly his popularity goes up. He wants to play the Russian nationalism card. We should be playing the corruption card, the economic weakness card. He's not doing well by the Russian people. And if that would be the focus instead of how he's restoring some notion of Russian greatness, that is the issue on which he's vulnerable.
Although the latest surveys suggest that Putin's popularity remains high in Russia, and Paul Wolfowitz doesn't exactly have the best track record on predicting future political and military events. But Republican Congressman Mike Rogers, meanwhile, told Meet the Press over the weekend that the U.S. has no choice but to make the right call on a response to Russia. Rogers says he's worried that Russia may be getting the message right now that Europe and the U.S. are just going to let the annexation of Crimea slide.
I do think that we have to, as Americans, have to take a tough stand with our European partners. There are things that we can do that I think we're not doing. I don't think the rhetoric matches the reality on the ground.
It's Chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Congressman Mike Rogers, on Meet the Press. Joining us now, Kurt Volker, who served as the American ambassador to NATO back in 2008. Mr. Ambassador, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
So I've been looking at scenarios really for the past week now, and it seems that there are two themes. One would basically escalate incrementally the sanctions regime, and I suspect that's what they're going to be talking about at the G7 meeting. But there's also a lot of talk about making an end run around Putin's energy resources and getting the U.S. and Qatar to possibly supply Europe's source of natural gas. Do you think either of those are viable and are all going to be done?
Well, on the first one, the escalation of sanctions, I think that is the plan that the U.S. and the European Union have. The idea is to not rise into an immediate conflict if that's avoidable, but to make clear that we're prepared to continue to escalating to get Putin to stop, and also that we will not recognize his takeover of Crimea and hope that eventually that could be reversed. On the gas issues, I think that's a longer-term issue. The LNG receptors in Europe are really not ready quite yet, and so the volume of gas needed to replace Russian gas couldn't be brought in so easily and so quickly. In the long run, though, I think that is exactly what should happen. And for general reasons of market efficiency, let alone dependence on Russia, just to create a diversity of supply for Europe to keep costs down. Europe pays a lot more for natural gas than we do here in the United States, for example.
As someone who really knows, you were ambassador in 2008 during the Georgia crisis. Does the NATO Common Defense Treaty obligation make this a fundamentally different situation in Crimea? And thinking about the neighbors of Russia, including Poland and the Baltic states, does that limit the hand of NATO, or does it strengthen the hand of NATO?
I would say that it invokes some NATO responsibilities that we have yet to see play out. First, NATO has an obligation to the protection of the territory of its members. And that includes the Baltic states and Poland and Romania and Bulgaria, all of them right in that region around Ukraine. And they are concerned at what they see, the massing of Russian forces on Ukraine's eastern border, the takeover of Crimea, the possibility that the Transnistrian part of Moldova would also be taken over by Russia, as well as other potential moves in Ukraine. So reassuring those allies, which we have begun to do on a bilateral basis, is something that we could continue to do more assertively through NATO. The second part, that's the defense part. The second part is a deterrence part. How do we actually deter Russia from more adventurism in the East? How do we put in place measures that will change his calculation, change Putin's calculation, to thinking that maybe there will be a tougher response, perhaps even some kind of military response that's going to be harmful to him and his forces that would cause him not to take those additional steps. So putting in place some of those deterrent things. That would be, for example, military advisors to the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense and military, providing them some additional equipment, maybe some exercising with NATO forces in the area around Ukraine so that there are pieces on the chessboard that Putin will have to take into account.
But aren't we back in a sort of Warsaw Pact strategic imbalance in this situation on some level? I mean, the Russians can mass as many troops as they want on their western frontier. And there's very little that Europe and the U.S. can do about it. And we're suddenly talking about Russia and deterrence all over again. Man, that sounds like the Cold War.
Well, it does. But remember, what we're looking at now looks a little bit like the 1930s, which is a country declaring that the citizens of another country who happen to speak the same language somehow belong to them and that's their citizens, and that the territory of that country really is rightfully part of another country and they're just going to take it militarily. That's not the kind of thing that you can just let go easily.
You alluded to the territorial dispute in Moldova, which may be slipping into the Crimea scenario. Does it raise the stakes in that if Romania claims that there's actually some sort of encroachment, that does get us closer to the common defense obligations of NATO than Crimea does? Or does Moldova simply constitute a smaller version of Crimea, in your view?
Well, I think it represents a significant escalation and a significant risk. Moldova is also not a member of NATO, like Ukraine is not a member of NATO. So we have no obligation to try to defend Moldova. In addition, Russian peacekeepers are already present in Transnistria. They've been there for some years under a UN mandate, but they have thus far not, they've divided the country de facto, but they haven't actually annexed it or made it part of a greater Russian empire. If that were to happen and Russia were to take those further steps of making that also part of Russia like it has done with Crimea, it then raises a big red flag to Ukraine. Because if your listeners here take a look at a map, you've got Crimea on the eastern part of the Ukrainian Black Sea coast, and you've got Transnistria to the west of Ukraine, also somewhat to the south. And there would be a temptation or an expectation that maybe Russia is now going to try to connect these territories along the Ukrainian Black Sea coast through a place like Odessa. So it's really going to raise a lot of worries about where those Russian forces massed on the Ukrainian border might really go. They could be trying to do a land grab all across Ukraine.
And as Congressman Rogers suggested over the weekend, nobody knows what map is in the mind of Vladimir Putin right now. In retrospect, thinking back to the Georgia crisis in 2008, do you think there is anything that could have been done by the U.S. and the allies that would have prevented what's going on right now from occurring?
I do think that we were not as aggressively engaged in promoting a Europe whole, free, and at peace over the last several years. This is something that was important in the Clinton administration, the Bush administration. We saw countries like Poland, Baltic states join NATO. That was a very effective way of promoting democracy, market economy, and security for 100 million plus people. We kind of slowed down on that because of the financial crisis, because of fatigue, because of the conflicts in Afghanistan, and because the countries we're talking about were not as developed. But without that kind of magnet being created in the West to say, we want you to develop and be part of a community, and then providing assistance to help with that, the local bad forces, and we saw this in Ukraine, we see it in the Balkans, you see the local forces there promote nationalism and separatism. And that destroys these societies.
And nationalism is really the prevailing mood right now. We'll see what happens. Kurt Volker served as American ambassador to NATO back in 2008. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You will recall that we have created a parallel NCAA tournament to put TV characters head-to-head. The NCAA began in the same year as television. Bet you didn't know that. Our tournament and the NCAA contests came through the first weekend with a lot of surprises. In round one, it was Data of Star Trek Next Generation versus Don Draper of Mad Men, and Cinderella Data came out ahead with 62.4% of the votes.
You could say, I have a magnetic personality.
Considerably less surprising, the Lemon Lady defeated the Dragon Queen, Liz Lemon from 30 Rock, the big winner over Daenerys Targaryen of Game of Thrones, winning 68.6% of the votes. Could there be anything sweeter for Liz Lemon?
I don't know. You ever put a donut in the microwave?
So we continue. Today entering the arena is Tony Soprano of The Sopranos and Saul Goodman from Breaking Bad.
What if Tony Soprano was your husband?
You and the furniture and the clothes and the cars. You would have spent everything I made if I let you.
Or your father.
You broke up. How long do you want to cry about it?
Or your son.
What kind of a chance did she have with you as her mother?
Part of the reason why Tony Soprano is so compelling, so easy to like, even to love, is that in watching The Sopranos, you start to think, maybe being a member of that family wouldn't be all that bad.
Oh! Oh!
Tony Soprano is a liar, a cheater, a murderer. He's absolutely terrifying. But, first and foremost, he's a family man.
Someday soon, you're going to have families of your own. And if you're lucky, you'll remember the little moments, like this, that were good.
Tony Soprano is the best character in television history. Vote for him at thetakeaway.org.
The best character on TV, of course, is Breaking Bad's bus bench lawyer, the one and only Saul Goodman.
My real name's Miguel. The Jew thing I just do for the homeboys. They all want a pipe-hitting member of the tribe, so to speak.
From his cheap suits to his Bill of Rights-themed office, Saul Goodman screams American justice, scumbag style.
If you're committed enough, you can make any story work. I once convinced a woman that I was Kevin Costner, and it worked. Because I believed it.
Hey, everyone knows Walter and Jesse would have been busted if not for their underworld guide.
You two suck at peddling meth.
Saul, played by Bob Odenkirk, brings the laughs to a dark world, but he's also the only one who isn't deluded about what he is.
Conscience gets expensive, doesn't it?
Where did Saul come from? How did he get through law school?
Lucky, month from now, best case scenario, I'm managing a Cinnabon in Omaha.
No, you won't, Saul. America loves you so much that you're getting your own show. What more proof do you need that for TV's best character of all time?
Better call Saul!
That's Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick and Takeaway associate producer Ellen Frankman on Saul Goodman from Breaking Bad versus Tony Soprano of The Sopranos. Please share your fury over our brackets, give us your nominations, and it's up to you to vote. Go to our website at thetakeaway.org. And now how a collision between reproductive technology and child custody laws led to a legal battle back in the 1980s that got the attention of the world.
A trial without legal precedent continued to unfold in a New Jersey court today. At issue, custody of babies born to surrogate mothers.
The contract Mrs. Whitehead signed stated she would not try to keep the baby.
The team from Retro Report this week takes us to the 1986 case of Baby M. Mary Beth Whitehead was a surrogate mom hired by a couple, William Stern and his wife Betsy, to conceive and give birth to a child with William's sperm. When Whitehead delivered a baby girl, she had a sudden change of heart and decided to keep the baby she had signed a contract with the Sterns to relinquish. Whitehead and her husband fled New Jersey with the baby, and a nationwide search for Baby M began.
Whitehead had been hiding in Florida for 87 days when police found her at her mother's house and took the infant away.
But it would be up to the courts to decide who this baby belonged to in the end, the surrogate mom who delivered her, or the family of the father, William Stern. Jill Rosenbaum, Retro Report producer, joins me now. Jill, welcome.
Thank you.
Jill, describe the legal chaos that ensued when this baby was born and how unprepared, really, the law was for this situation.
Well, surrogacy was a tiny piece of the reproductive landscape at that time. It was something people did maybe within families or, there were starting to be a few lawyers around the country putting these arrangements together. But there was no law surrounding them. There was no case law surrounding them. There had never been a conflict like this. And so when Mary Beth Whitehead suddenly decided she wanted to keep the baby, there was absolutely no precedent for it. And interestingly, she went to the media before the case got to court. And so what would have normally been a closed private custody matter became just an international, I don't even know how to describe it. You know, it was just...
It was an unprecedented, all bets are off kind of legal battle. And here's Gary Skoloff, who's an attorney for William and Betsy Stearns, who talked about how things were complicated in the very beginning.
The Stearns had a baby for several days. Then Mrs. Whitehead came back, very upset, and said she needed to have the child for a few days back in her house again, and then she would bring the baby back to the Stearns.
It was that sort of passing the baby back and forth that helped to make this case so inflamed.
Well, also, Mary Beth Whitehead had a flair for drama. And when she ran off to Florida with the baby, actually, the police came to her house to try to get the baby. She passed the baby out the window to her husband. They ran away. They were on the run for nearly 3 months. You know, she just was a very dramatic person. And so, you know, that led, the whole event to have this craziness about it.
And what law there was about this case really involved paying for babies, the idea that there would be trafficking in babies. And at one point, that was what this case looked most like to judges. Listen.
The court found the exchange of money for a child illegal, perhaps criminal, and potentially degrading to women.
And was that court in New Jersey or in Florida or where?
That was the New Jersey Supreme Court. So the Stearns and the Whiteheads all were residents of New Jersey. So, you know, that's where the baby was born, and that's where the custody battle took place. And interestingly, the lower court, the first court to look at the case, said that the surrogacy agreement was, in fact, completely enforceable and legal, took away Mrs. Whitehead's rights, and, you know, said the Stearns could have the baby free and clear. But then Mrs. Whitehead appealed, and the state Supreme Court took an extremely tough line on this. Not only did they say that it was essentially baby selling, but they were unanimous in saying it.
And let's talk about the lessons. So certainly what this case set in motion was a drama that eventually did get resolved. But now surrogacy is a much less exotic procedure. There are many, many more people doing it. What are the lessons learned from this case?
Well, it's interesting. You know, right after the Baby M case, several states, Michigan, New York, New Jersey itself, obviously, you know, made it clear that they weren't going to have it. It was some states passed laws against it. Some states passed laws limiting it so that people couldn't do it if money was involved, you know, but maybe your sister could do it for you or something like that. But most states didn't really deal with it. And so what happened is it kind of grew up as this unregulated business. And now you have places where people go on Craigslist looking for surrogates, or you have very sort of well-run agencies that function almost like adoption agencies. One of the owners of an agency called it the Wild West, you know, because it's really state by state. Family law is a state matter. The other thing I think that's important to know is that Baby M was Mary Beth Whitehead's biological child. But around the same time that surrogacy was getting popular, so was a procedure called in vitro fertilization, where an egg and sperm could be joined outside of a woman's body and then reimplanted. And so what has happened is lots of surrogacy now is egg donor surrogacy. So the baby is not the biological child of the surrogate. So unlike Baby M, who literally was Mary Beth Whitehead's child biologically, a lot of surrogate children are not.
You alluded to this Wild West notion, which is exactly what John Weltman, president and founder of Circle Surrogacy, told you.
I think it is the Wild West in surrogacy because there's no required license. You don't have to be a lawyer. You don't have to be a social worker or a psychologist. People are entering this, some of whom are very honorable and some of whom are not so honorable. I'd like to see regulation take place.
Is there a clear takeaway on what regulations are needed here, Jill?
Well, it's interesting. The American Bar Association has a committee that drafted legislation, kind of model legislation, that they would like to see states pass. And a couple of states have tried, And a few have actually passed legislation to have their governors veto it. So I think our country on some level still has ambivalence about this. And I think for politicians, it's a really tough area. And so I don't know that things are going to change so quickly.
Speaking to us from Washington, D.C., Jill Rosenbaum is a Retro Report producer talking about the Baby M case back in 1986. Jill, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So over at thetakeaway.org, some of you are throwing away our TV brackets and coming up with your own greatest TV characters of all time.
Don St. Clair calling from Eugene, Oregon. Hi, John. And it's Doctor Who, of course.
Fez. I wear a Fez now. Fezes are cool.
The immortal, amazing Doctor Who. Who else could be the most amazing, incredible, best character ever on television? Come on already. Thanks, Doctor Who.
But so many of you are also voting on our TV bracket contests. Can Tony shut down Saul below the post, get the rebound, and vote over at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews. Now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com.
In Snohomish County, Washington State, a tragedy is unfolding after a mudslide destroyed close to 30 homes, killing people and obliterating a rural neighborhood on the edge of the mountains and the sea. Joining us from the Seattle-Tacoma area is Gabriel Spitzer, health and science reporter and assistant news director for KPLU. Gabriel, welcome.
Thanks, John.
There's certainly no nothing odd about rain and heavy rainfall in the Pacific Northwest, but how did weather contribute to this sudden disaster that really just opened up a huge opening in a relatively tranquil mountain area?
Well, you've got that right. Rain is nothing unusual, but this has been a wetter than average March in this area, although ironically the slide happened during a kind of a sunny break over the weekend when people may not necessarily have been looking out for it. But this is a very wet area, and it's actually not all that tranquil. It's quite near a site where about 8 years ago a smaller slide had taken place, so the geography and the geology of the area kind of contribute to a high risk of slides. And these kind of foothills of the Cascade Mountains are prone to this sort of thing. It's a constantly, sloughing off here and there. But this was obviously something that was way out of proportion for the norm. A square mile of devastation, as many as a million cubic yards of debris blocking a major state highway, well, a smallish state highway, and also for a period of time damming the North Fork of the Stillaguamish River.
Mm. What did people tell you it was like in the moments as this really began to happen?
Well, we heard from one eyewitness who is named Sierra Sansaver. She's 18 years old. She lives in Arlington, Washington, and she was driving down State Route 530 at the time. And she describes kind of approaching the scene and seeing some emergency vehicles, lights, and some debris, and not really knowing what was going on. And then rounding a corner and happening upon a house in the middle of the road. And if that wasn't a disorienting enough thing to stumble upon, what happened next was even worse. You know, she got out of her car and was walking around taking some photographs and trying to figure out what had happened. It wasn't obvious to her what was going on. And then she began to hear something, and maybe we can hear a little of that tape.
Everybody started showing up, and they started hearing a little kid screaming. And that's when everybody ran out there, and they found a six-month-old baby. And I was inches from seeing everything.
And everything includes the fate of the missing that they're still trying to sort out there in Snohomish County.
That's right. More than a dozen people at least are still unaccounted for. That's based on just people who lived in this slide area who haven't checked in or been found. That six-month-old baby, assuming it was the same person who was checked into the trauma center here in Seattle, is in critical condition as of last night.
Are local emergency preparedness institutions aware of the risk of slides? Is there a real sort of plan for this kind of a situation?
Well, there is not a lot you can do except for not develop or build in some of these areas. So, yes, people are definitely aware of it here. And, you know, it's also a real issue during the search and rescue effort. I mean, they had to be called off at several points over the course of the weekend because conditions were just too unstable. The debris field has been described many times to us as being like quicksand. And at one point, one rescue crew working on Saturday had to be rescued themselves. They sunk up to their armpits in this muck and had to be pulled out with ropes.
Gabriel Spitzer, health and science reporter and assistant news director for KPLU Public Radio in Seattle, Washington. Gabriel, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
A man-made disaster in the busy Houston Ship Channel on Saturday, spilling as much as 168,000 gallons from a colliding barge, according to officials from the U.S. Coast Guard. The channel has been closed as crews work to contain a spill that has happened just as tens of thousands of seabirds are arriving for the annual spring migration. Bob Stokes is president of the Galveston Bay Foundation. He joins us from Galveston, Texas. Bob, welcome.
Hello.
So what is the threat here, the immediate threat to the environment, and how long will that ship channel remain closed?
The immediate threat is the oil that is accumulated throughout the Galveston Bay system and now into the Gulf of Mexico, oil that has impacted birds, may impact crabs, fish, shrimp, dolphins. You know, we've got shorelines with oil on them, marshes with oil. So it's a big mess right now.
Is there a cause to this accident? Is it known at this point, or still under investigation?
It's still under investigation, but generally speaking, this type of accident is going to be caused either by mechanical failure or human error. And this occurred during a time when we had a pretty significant fog out in Galveston Bay. So I suspect that there was a loss of communication in some fashion, which led to this collision.
What are the conditions that might help in the containment of this spill, and what conditions are actually working against people at this hour?
Well, it's an interesting question because we've actually had bad conditions for containment. We've had a lot of weather that's passed through. We had a front that passed through out of the north, which has blown a lot of this oil out of Galveston Bay into the Gulf of Mexico. So from a Galveston Bay perspective, it's been fairly good conditions. It hasn't been easy to contain the oil, but the prevailing winds have been out of the north, and this happened at the south end of our system. So it pushes a lot of this oil through Bolivar Pass out into the Gulf of Mexico, and we had reports last night that there was oil up to 12 miles out into the Gulf, and I think it's even further out there this morning.
What are the species? I alluded to the tens of thousands of seabirds arriving for the annual spring migration. What are the species that might be affected here? And we recall the deep water disaster, the BP disaster in the Gulf had a real impact on pelicans who were breeding right at the moment of that spill.
Yeah, we have a wide variety of shorebirds and water birds. You know, we've got gulls, terns, skimmers, sandpipers, pelicans, oyster catchers. The list goes on. And you know, they're all equally exposed to this type of impact. Interestingly enough, as of yesterday, the Coast Guard had only confirmed, and really I got reports on this morning as well, the Coast Guard had only confirmed impacts to 10 birds, which in my estimation is well below what I think is really out there. Five were deceased and five were going to be attempted to be rehabilitated. Because we've got, you know, tens of thousands of birds out there, and I suspect we're getting a lot of calls about impacted wildlife, and I suspect there's a lot more out there.
Well, at least that is a positive detail that may change in the coming hours. What's the mobilization to minimize the damage to the species?
You know, we're fortunate here. We have a significant petrochemical presence in Galveston Bay, and we're fortunate in the sense that we've got about as good oil spill response here in Galveston Bay as I think there is in the world. With that said, I understand that there's about 69,000 feet of boom that's been laid, so it's over 13 miles of boom. There's another 141,000 feet ready to be laid if it's needed. There are 24 active response vessels that are out there in the water skimming or trying to contain. But ultimately, you know, what the biggest factor that we can't control here is the weather. And with this wind and rain that we had after the spill, really most of the oil is uncontained. I'd be surprised, you know, to learn if they had any decent percentage of it skimmed and off the water. In reality, a lot of it's just being pushed out into the Gulf.
Bob Stokes is president of the Galveston Bay Foundation on the line from Webster, Texas. Bob, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
It was a journey that was to have begun in Kuala Lumpur and was to have ended in Beijing more than 2 weeks ago. Today, Malaysian authorities announced what they believe is the end of the journey for Flight 370.
With deep sadness and regret that I must inform you that according to this new data, Flight MH370 ended in the southern Indian Ocean.
Satellite data is reportedly behind this announcement from Malaysia's Prime Minister Najib Razak. What is an ending apparently detected by Inmarsat, the communications company with satellite monitoring throughout the world, will end little for the families with loved ones aboard Flight 370. And the Malaysian Prime Minister seemed to sense that in today's statement.
We wanted to inform you of this new development at the earliest opportunity. We share this information out of a commitment to openness and respect for the families, two principles which have guided this investigation.
First and foremost, it is the families who have the greatest interest in this information, but tragically, they may be the ones for whom the details that may now start emerging with little pieces of wreckage and other anonymous details, for whom these new details may solve no mysteries about the fate of their loved ones. While flight safety officials now try to sketch out what happened aboard the Boeing 777, the journey that these families of Flight 370 are on and will remain on for some time to come is a long and sadly familiar journey. Pauline Boss is the author of Ambiguous Loss, Learning to Live with Unresolved Grief. She's professor of psychology at the University of Minnesota.
With my over 30 years experience with families of missing people, my assumption is that these families, too, will not accept the fact of death at this point in time. And in fact, ambiguous loss, which this is, there's never any closure. And so people keep thinking what I call both and. You know, they're probably dead, but maybe not. My loved one is never coming back, but maybe they will. And this sort of thinking is not what I call magical thinking at all. It's actually a realistic thinking when you don't have the facts, when you don't have a body to bury, when you don't have DNA evidence. This is typical to say, well, they're probably dead, but maybe not.
But there's been an unprecedented drama that's been taking place with the families right in the middle of it during all of this time. How unique is that, and what do you think it does to compound or contribute to the grief process?
I was very upset when I saw that. I think, you know, having 50 microphones around them and cameras is a double traumatizing of the families. And I was glad to hear that they're asking for patience with the families and asking them to have their privacy. They need to be in a private place, talking with each other, talking with counselors. I already Skyped with some counselors from Kuala Lumpur. They're very competent. They're working with the families. But only the people who want to talk with the press should talk with the press. And the press should realize that we need more patience with people who have no body to bury, with people who have no evidence yet. You know, in the absence of facts, all theories are probable. And when the families say my loved one might be on top of an airplane wing in the middle of the Indian Ocean, I don't contradict that. I think we should just listen patiently.
What is the meaning of the artifacts that may begin emerging now? Pieces of a fuselage, anonymous bits of airplane that can't be traced to any individual. Does it matter what pieces are found? Does it have to be a body intact, a suitcase? How are those artifacts painful, poignant, difficult?
Well, different people will have a different meaning for it. And that's the other thing that we need to have patience for, is not everybody will see it the same way. Some people will say, well, clearly the plane went down, so my loved one is dead. But many people will say, well, clearly the plane went down, and then they have some sort of other thinking. Well, maybe they floated to an island somewhere. And at first, I just don't challenge that thinking. It is the way that the brain tries to cope with an unfathomable loss and that has no absolute fact about it. In other words, truth is elusive here. You can surmise the truth, but because the grief is so unresolved, the loss is unresolved, actually, not the grief, but therefore the grief is unresolved. And years later, people with ambiguous loss will say things like, I think I saw him on a crowded street the other day.
Even if they've been told.
Yes.
It's a crash.
Yes.
Perhaps something that helps to explain why this story has had so much attention. I mean, in the time that this drama has unfolded, thousands have died in various places around the world, and war zones and conflicts and starvation and all the tragedies that go with humanity's life on Earth. But maybe what makes this special is that this is everyone's greatest fear, this
it
poof,
is.
You're gone.
Especially in mastery-oriented cultures, a can-do cultures like ours, where we like to find the answer to a problem. We're accustomed to solving problems. And here's a problem that may never have an answer. It may never have a clear answer. Even if we find out we have bits of that plane, we will still never know where these people are. They may be at the bottom of the ocean. No doubt they are, but the families will say, we don't have evidence in front of us. We don't have a body to bury. That is everyone's worst nightmare, yes. Worst nightmare.
And it's why, no matter how long we have flight, a plane crash is always in the top list of ways you don't want to go, because it does raise that issue of they may never recover you.
There are other ways, of course. Scandinavian fishermen for centuries have disappeared, and then the villages have a joint funeral once a year to deal with that. In 9/11 here, many people still haven't been found, no DNA evidence for at least half of the people, I understand. And missing in action soldiers and refugees who can't find their families. Ambiguous loss is very common in the world. It's just a rough kind of loss. It's more difficult than a clear-cut death because of the not knowing.
Well, the Malaysians say the loss is now a fact, but the details could remain ambiguous forever.
Yeah, in the eyes of the family, the loss won't be a fact until they see the bodies. So up until that time, they have to make meaning out of a sort of nonsensical situation.
Pauline Boss is professor of psychology at the University of Minnesota, author of Ambiguous Loss, Learning to Live with Unresolved Grief. Pauline, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In a crowded world with growing needs for energy and clean water in one community, something has got to give, and it has in North Carolina, where the nation's largest electricity company, Duke Energy, has a 61 million gallon dirty water problem, water contaminated from a coal ash pit that made it into the Cape Fear River. This comes only weeks after the company coated the Dan River with 39,000 tons of toxic coal ash sludge along the North Carolina-Virginia border. Duke Energy, in an elaborate statement issued to us and the media, they would not supply us with an interview subject or a representative of the company. Duke Energy says the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources has approved the company's emergency plans for repairing a waste dam near the Cape Fear River and testing and cleaning up all of the contamination. You can see the complete statement at thetakeaway.org. Michael Biesacker is a reporter for the Associated Press who's been following this story. Michael, welcome.
Hello, John. Thanks for having me.
Kemp Burdett is also with us. He's riverkeeper and executive director of Cape Fear River Watch. Kemp, what are you most worried about right now?
I think I'm most worried about the, you know, roughly 500,000 people who get their drinking water out of the Cape Fear River downstream from the Cape Fear coal ash ponds, five coal ash ponds that are rated at the highest level of hazard.
And what kind of chemicals are we talking about here?
We're talking about heavy metals like arsenic, lead, manganese, iron, thallium, selenium. None of these are what you want to have in your drinking water.
That's Kemp Burdett, who is the riverkeeper and executive director of Cape Fear River Watch. Michael Biesecker, how do you think the regulatory environment in North Carolina may have contributed to this disaster, if at all?
Well, it's tough to say that the regulatory environment might have caused a pipe to collapse. You know, coal ash is a problem that we've dealt with for decades in North Carolina, and certainly the regulatory environment being sort of favorable to Duke Energy being able to maintain those ash ponds by the river is nothing new. But there was an emphasis with the election of Governor Pat McCrory in 2012 when he took office, with saying that they wanted a more business-friendly regulatory environment as far as being pro-job creation when they came to enforcing environmental rules. They were very open about that. In some cases, they've actually mocked groups like the Southern Environmental Law Center that was trying to sue Duke Energy about its coal ash pollution. So certainly there had been an environment within the last year where environmental enforcement was arguably de-emphasized in favor of creating jobs.
Well, there's no arguing with the fact that you certainly made the governor pretty testy when you confronted this pro-business approach as a possible conflict of interest. Can you describe that?
Well, we had tried to speak with the governor about the coal ash spill at the Dan River. This was, I think, the following week. He was at a press conference where he was talking about snow removal. We had just had a large storm. But our governor worked for Duke Energy for 28 years before retiring to run for office. So certainly he's closely tied with Duke Energy. The company and its employees have been very forceful political contributors on his behalf. And I wanted to ask him about that.
I've stated in my records that I have some 401k in my original 401k, some Duke Energy value, but in my 14 years as mayor of Charlotte, in my 1 year as governor, I separate. I'm very proud of the job we've done as governor. I didn't. Excuse me, sir. But you have not been recognized. Okay. And I'd be glad to take any other. Sir, excuse me, sir. I told you I'd get John Scavarla back with you, and we'd be glad to answer your questions. But it's no time to be disrespectful.
An exchange between Governor McCrory in North Carolina and my guest, Michael Biesecker, who is a reporter for the Associated Press. Duke Energy is focused very much on their emergency response to deal with this dam break and any cleanup. Is the governor considering this an emergency, and are state agencies sort of engaged along with Duke in a cleanup effort?
They were a little slow to do that. The first press releases that came from the state about the spill didn't really emphasize the magnitude of it. And the governor, I think it was 4 days before he gave any public statement at all about the spill. But in the last month, they have taken more action. They've issued, I believe, 8 environmental violations against Duke within the last month over not only the Dan River spill, but issues at other Duke sites. There's 14 sites in the state that have these coal ash dumps. So within the last month, the state certainly has become more aggressive in enforcing clean water laws.
Kemp Burdett, do you believe the state would have acted and the company would have acted had you not contributed to the discovery of this problem?
No, I do not believe that they would have reacted at least as quickly as they did. I think having the Waterkeepers Alliance, Cape Fear Riverkeeper, you know, provide photographs of illegal activities certainly prompted the state to act.
And how out ahead of this were you in terms of days or hours?
We had photographs on Monday, and I think the state issued a notice of violation over a week later.
And in terms of the people that you serve, do you think they'll be dealing with this for a matter of weeks, months, or is this a contamination that could have permanent impact?
You know, there's a crack in that dam right now that looks, you know, potentially problematic. So you know, if that dam were to break, we'd have real problems. They've already pumped 61 million gallons of coal ash waste and coal ash waste water into the river. You know, I think ecologically, we're probably going to deal with this for a long time, and I hope that right now we're not dealing with any human health impacts.
Kemp Burdette is riverkeeper and executive director of the Cape Fear River Watch. Kemp, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And our thanks to Michael Biesecker, who is a reporter for the Associated Press.
Thank you. Have a great day.
How you doing on the NCAA tournament? Anybody make it to the Sweet 16 with all 16 teams correct? The answer to that, I think, is probably no. Earlier in this hour, we had our showdown between Tony Soprano and Saul Goodman of Breaking Bad. You can head over to thetakeaway.org and cast your vote for the greatest television characters of all time. Be sure to call us with some personal favorites.
Hey, John, this is Brian calling from Charleston, South Carolina. You have to choose Lucy Ricardo as the number one television character of all time. She is the mother of all wacky characters.
Brian, you have no idea, dude, how much I am with you. Just you wait. From Meridian, Connecticut, Heathcliff Huxtable, The Cosby Show was and is funny and good for the soul. Great from Meridian. Heathcliff was definitely considered for our bracket.
My name is Kristen. I'm calling from Port Orange, Florida. I would have to say some of the most significant people of past TV time would have to be the Golden Girls. I think each and every one of them had something kind of great and positive to give to everybody, of strong women who were living on their own as elderly people.
I'm Mike. I'm from East Rockaway, and I gotta say my favorite television character has to be Ned Stark from Game of Thrones.
The man who passes the sentence should swing the sword.
He is one of a kind, not to mention a true example of how a man should act.
Hi, this is Melissa from Elizabeth, New Jersey. I think that Steve Carell should be on the TV SmackDown.
So older people have just as many rights as younger people?
Yes.
He was the first person to truly popularize that awkward humor that everybody takes advantage of now.
Hi, this is Ed from Maine. My favorite character of all time would have to be, well, the two of them, Rocky and Bullwinkle. Greatest cartoon characters.
Today's subject is how to get into the movies without buying a ticket.
Rocky, Bullwinkle, Mr. Peabody, Boris, and Natasha, so good. Finally from Jacksonville, Florida, Dexter, a killer for a cause. What could be better?
Keeping my face pinched in sorrow for 2 hours straight is a real chore.
Who do you think could be better than Dexter? Don't worry, you're not going to get killed over it. Let us know at 8778MYTAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. We need your votes to figure out the greatest TV characters of all time. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.